The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Next case is 23AP255, Melissa Hubbard versus Carol Newman, M.D. Could I have your appearances, please? No problem. No problem. All right. The lineup that I have is 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and then 5 minutes on rebuttal. And we are ready to proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. We're here today on review of an order denying a motion to dismiss on the pleadings and a Court of Appeals decision affirming that order regarding a claim for failure to obtain informed consent under Section 4.
It's I don't know if everyone can hear you.
Sir.
I don't know if you need to pull the microphone closer, or as I say to my kids, use your inside scream.
Does that help at all?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Briefly, again, we are here on the review of an order denying a motion to dismiss on the pleadings and an appellate decision affirming that order on the issue of whether the complaint stated a claim for failure to obtain informed consent under Section 448.30 against Dr. Carol Newman. We submit that this matter presents an issue first impression under the informed consent statute, which briefly stated, does the duty to inform extend to a treating physician who refers a patient to another physician and who has conversations with that other physician in which she makes comments, ideas, and offers a recommendation as to one particular mode of treatment that other physician may perform during the course of the treatment that he will provide?
So which translated means, what's a shorter statement of your issue?
A shorter statement of the issue, Justice, is does a referring treating physician have a duty to inform a patient she has told the other physician to whom the patient has been referred, here's what I think you should do while you're performing this procedure.
In that statement, you are referring to your client as a treating physician, correct?
Yes.
So there's no issue that your client was a treating physician here?
There is not, Justice. She was the OBGYN, Mrs. Hubbard, briefly, I think just beginning in January, but she was a...
The question I have about the way you phrased it, and I know we're trying to do a shorter statement, which I appreciate, but isn't that kind of leaving out some of these facts, which we have to take as true at this point because it's a motion to dismiss? And so it's not just that she referred and had a discussion and made a recommendation, but also the allegations in the complaint in paragraph 10 are that she was going to participate in the surgery, that she was going to do the removal of the tubes, ovaries, and uterus, which is what is the issue here, and she would participate and do that. So it's beyond just a referral or a recommendation, at least as alleged, right?
Well, yes, Justice, it is alleged that that was the intention or that was the expectation, at least as between the physicians, but it never happened.
Okay, but when you say it never happened, I can't consider that. So it seems to me like this motion to dismiss is a problem for you, because if it was a motion for summary judgment, we would have more facts, but the only facts we have are this complaint, right?
I would call the Justice's attention to paragraph 13 of the complaint, in which the plaintiff alleged, and this is factually correct, that Dr. McCauley actually removed Mrs. Hubbard's ovaries. There is no allegation that she actually ultimately participated in the surgery.
But if I'm remembering the facts correctly, she was in the surgical operating room and was ready, willing, and able to do so, right? So she was more than just a treating physician. She was a surgeon as well who was planning to participate, and then the plan changed. Is that correct?
And, Your Honor, Your Justice, you alluded to the fact that this is a kind of unique situation because it was an earlier lawsuit. So the plaintiff did have the benefit of some discovery, certainly, into the underlying facts to inform the complaint that they filed in this case. To answer Your Honor's question, Dr. Newman was in the OR for a very brief period, for about 20 minutes. The evidence was that she was there to observe, not to perform any part of the procedure at that point. She had other patients scheduled.
But that's not for us to consider either, right? We're just looking at this complaint.
On the issue that we have raised, yes, the focus is on the complaint.
And the complaint says on paragraph 10, both Newman and McCauley would perform the surgery. That's what they had discussed. Newman to surgically remove the tube ovaries and McCauley to surgically remove the colon. And then of course, later on, paragraph 13, as you make reference to, it is McCauley that performed the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
This
correct,
is what's
Justice.
Alleged in the complaint.
That's correct,
paragraph
Justice.
10.
I would note it's not alleged that Mrs. Hubbard understood or believed that Dr. Newman would be performing a part of the surgery. I think that's relevant related to some of the other cases that we cited that I'll. But correct, we are going from the allegations in the complaint. And briefly stated, we've already reviewed those undisputed facts in the complaint, I guess.
Does it change your statement of the issue, whether it's your longer version or your shorter version, by replacing the word does, as you utilized, to can?
So can the physician have a duty?
Mm-hmm.
Under the facts alleged, I believe the answer is no and should be no. We discuss a number of cases, of course, from other jurisdictions with different facts where the referring treating physician's involvement in the subsequent care went well beyond making recommendations, even well beyond observing, where that physician actually ordered the treatment be done by another physician who effectively functioned as their employee.
With different facts, then.
With
so
different facts.
So it seems to me, and push back with this, if you will, it seems to me that if you rephrase it to can, and then the rest of your language, I think the answer is it depends. It depends on the facts. Am I right or wrong?
It depends on the facts with the proviso that I don't know that the court needs to decide under the alleged facts of this case whether to adopt the specific rulings of the other cases regarding what if a referring treating physician orders the other doctor to perform the procedure. It's enough, I think, to determine under our statute whether the referring treating physician has a duty to inform of a recommendation that is made. Conceding the facts alleged is true, I believe that's the issue.
I'm really confused by the posture of this case because setting aside the arguments that are being made over the law, this woman's real complaint is the allegation that her ovaries were removed and no one told her they were going to remove her ovaries. So we're talking about, I'm trying to figure out how we got to this point. It appears that the circuit court decided to interpret the complaint as one stating a claim for informed consent, but the complaint is not that she wasn't advised of alternative modes of treatment and the risks and benefits of different modes of treatment. It's sort of, if we go back to older common law, it's kind of a battery. If a doctor removes somebody's body part without telling them that that is what they're planning to do, that is a terrible invasion. It is a battery under common law, I believe. But it really has nothing to do with whether somebody told her about alternative medical modes of treatment and the benefits and risks of these treatments. So I'm just not understanding how this case came here. And then we have the Court of Appeals saying that Dr. Newman had a duty to inform Hubbard about the availability, benefits, risks of reasonable alternate modes of treatment, but that's not what the complaint actually says at all. The complaint doesn't invoke the statute. The complaint doesn't, and maybe this better post your friend on the other side, but I'm just confused. Do you think that the framing by the lower courts of this case is accurate, correct, under the law?
Well, we interpret it as an informed consent claim, Justice, against
Dr. Newman. You agree with that as well?
Essentially, that the underlying claim, and I think as Mrs. Hubbard has argued throughout this, is that Dr. Newman failed to disclose that she made the recommendation for the removal of the ovaries. So she should have told Mrs. Hubbard, I spoke with Dr. McGauley, and here's what I told him I think he should do. We interpret that as an informed consent.
And isn't if I look at number 12 in the complaint, that Hubbard, prior to February 13, 2018, did not give her informed consent to McGauley to surgically remove her ovaries?
I apologize, Justice.
I'm not saying I have this figured out, Justice Bradley. I'm a little confused myself, but it is in the complaint. That part is in there.
Informed consent law?
It talks about informed consent. It does not cite the statute.
Well, I don't want to get into a dialogue. We can do this later. But what paragraph are you referring
12.
To?
12. Well, yes. So I'm a little confused as well, but I do see that in the complaint, I guess.
But that's with respect to, and I'll redirect the question, not to you,
no,
Justice,
that's fine.
to counsel. It says that Hubbard, prior to February 13, did not give her informed consent to McGauley to surgically remove her ovaries. That's what I understand the case to be about. So maybe I'm missing something, but we're talking about your client, Dr. Newman, not the one who removed. There's no allegation that your client removed the plaintiff's ovaries, correct?
Correct. Yes.
So I don't see an informed consent claim with respect to your client, but you disagree with me.
Well, I feel that that's how we've always interpreted this and how the lower courts did as well, because the allegation against Dr. Newman relating to the failure to disclose this communication she had with Dr. McGauley was, in effect, we interpret it as basically being not telling her about the likelihood of having her ovaries removed, which is comparable to what she alleges Dr. McGauley failed to do.
And this is a treatment for endometriosis. So that's the treatment, the mode of treatment, right? So that the mode of treatment was surgery, and the question was whether the ovaries could also be removed or not.
Correct. And removal of the ovaries, and this isn't in the complaint, I guess, but it is one method of treating endometriosis. So in a sense, it was an alternative mode. Once Dr. McGauley performed the surgery, determined that, in fact, she did have severe endometriosis, because Dr. Newman's note, which is in the complaint, references, I believe, suspected severe. And once that was confirmed, then he removed the ovaries as part of the as one of the alternatives for treating.
So just to clarify, go ahead, Chief.
Okay. So as Dr. Newman's patient, Dr. Newman discussed this possibility with the patient, and the patient did not want to go forward with having her ovaries removed, right?
Well, if we focus on what the...
I want to just focus on these facts. So did that happen or not? Or did they never discuss it?
You're asking, I'm sorry, the actual facts or what's alleged in the complaint?
Between Dr. Newman and the patient, was there a discussion about the possibility or the recommendation of removing ovaries?
We believe the evidence will show that there was, both with Dr. Newman and Dr. McGauley.
But Dr. Newman did not remove them.
Correct.
A different doctor did.
Yes.
So is your complaint that Dr. Newman needed to inform the patient that if she consulted with another doctor, she would tell that other doctor what her medical opinion was.
Yes, that's our understanding of the complaint, that Dr. Newman had a duty after she spoke with Dr. McGauley to tell Mrs. Hubbard, this is what I told him. This is what I recommended.
And what's the status of this case? If you were to win on this complaint, is the case over, or is the case still alive on the amended complaint?
Our position is the case is over. The amended complaint, I believe, only added Dr. Newman's liability carrier as a party. There were no additional substantive allegations made in the complaint. No new causes of action, I don't believe.
But you're saying you're defending Dr. Newman. If the plaintiff wins, that this complaint did not does set forth enough to go forward, you go to the next step where you would prove, you're telling us, which we can't consider, you're saying you'd prove that she was told. But right now we can't consider whether she was told or not. We just have to take it by the complaint because it's a motion to dismiss.
Correct.
Right. It just seemed like there's some confusion as to what the actual claim is. But the claim is about being informed of the discussion between the two doctors.
Correct.
So not to put too fine a point on this, just want to make sure. So do you agree with what the Court of Appeals said in Chapter 23 when they summed it up by saying, in sum, Hubbard's cause of action arises from Dr. Newman's alleged, quote, failure to inform, end of quote, Hubbard under WSSTAT 448.30 about her recommendation to the physician performing the surgery, rather than from Dr. Newman's failure to obtain Hubbard's consent to have her ovaries removed during the February 2018 surgery?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah, counsel, I just want to go back to the facts as alleged. I mean, generally speaking here, in a motion to dismiss, the rule is we're going to take these as true and including reasonable inferences therefrom. The Court of Appeals looks at the facts here and says in paragraph 31, it is reasonable to infer from these allegations that Dr. Newman not only had a physician-patient relationship with Hubbard, but also had expertise as an OBGYN regarding treatment options for pelvic endometriosis and was actively involved in Hubbard's care and in planning the February 2018 surgery, including plans for the removal of Hubbard's ovaries. So essentially saying she was far more involved in Hubbard's treatment and planning than in relating to some of the prior cases that were discussed. And so the facts do seem to present a picture of Dr. Newman, again, as we have to take them here, as being at least could be read as a kind of treating physician. Your arguments, legal arguments that you made in the brief, seem to require us to not conclude that, or that that's not a reasonable way to read the facts alleged in the complaint, again, most favorable to the other side. And so you want us to draw a line saying she, you know, not the treating physician, she didn't do it, therefore there was no duty. And I guess I'm having a hard time, given the facts as pled, given those inferences the Court of Appeals described, which, to put my cards a little bit on the table, seem right to me, that at least one could reasonably read that as saying Dr. Newman was involved in some way in this surgery. I mean, that is what that actually says, that could arguably create some duty as someone who treated her for this condition, and therefore maybe the duty to inform. How would you respond to that?
Well, thank you, Justice. I think that's what makes this so interesting. It's not a case where a physician referred a patient to another physician and said, you figure it out. I'm not involved. I'm not going to talk to you about this at all. But it's also not a case, I don't believe, and I may disagree with the Court of Appeals on this, where it can reasonably be inferred from the allegations in the complaint that Dr. Newman had anything more than, at most, a conversation with the doctor saying, with Dr. McGauley saying, here's what I recommend you do. no allegations that she had the authority to require him to do it or order him to do it. There is an allegation that she initially, at least, there was some discussion of her performing a part of the surgery, but that didn't happen. And so I agree, Justice, with what you're saying to the extent that Dr. Newman was involved beyond just referring the patient and washing her hands of it, but I don't believe it can be inferred from the allegations of the complaint fairly that her involvement rose to the level of that of the physicians in the many cases around the country that have held that there is a informed consent duty under the state's respective laws on the referring physician, where that referring physician actually performs part of the procedure or orders the other physician to do it.
If this court disagrees with just reading the complaint and the reasonable inferences from the complaint, with you maybe drawing a brighter line between her involvement, is there a way you can still prevail, or does your argument before us depend upon us reading the complaint in such a way that your client was not involved in the surgery?
Well, I think that the court could look at the other cases around the country, and of course our informed consent law comes from other states and is based to some degree on the law of other states, as the Court of Appeals correctly noted. The court could look at those other cases that have found a duty on the part of the referring treating physician, where that referring treating physician has actually ordered or controlled the procedure or participated in the procedure, and say, we're not going to follow that. And I don't know that we need to go there. But I think that our argument is that in order for us to prevail, frankly, the court needs at minimum to find that because Dr. Newman did not participate in, perform the procedure, or control the procedure being done, that the allegations in the complaint can't be interpreted to
can't,
make those
can't be interpreted
cannot be interpreted
so
to make those
you it is you you answered a question early on that you were admitting she was a treating physician, but what I hear you saying right now is that you're saying she wasn't.
She was
To me, that's what that hinges on, because the statute says any physician who treats a patient shall inform the patient. So if when you're saying things like she didn't participate or perform or control the procedure, that sounds like you're saying she wasn't the treating physician.
She wasn't the treating physician for the surgery.
Okay, so you are asking us to make an interpretation about treating physician.
Well, ultimately, yes. I mean, she was... Factually, I believe it's fair to say she was a treating physician in January as the OBGYN who met with Mrs. Hubbard, talked to her about her options and so forth. She
but in February for the surgery, she was not the treating physician.
Right. In terms of performing the procedure and participating in it, controlling it, she was not a treater at that time.
And so a broader holding would be only if you participate, perform, or control the procedure, are you a treating physician in the procedure?
Is
that what you're saying?
Minimum, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. So my colleagues are a little bit ahead of me. I'm still trying to set the table over here. I just want to make sure that, and that's what this case is about, right? It's about whether or not your client was the treating physician. And I just want to go to paragraph 24 in the Court of Appeals opinion, because I just want to make sure you agree with how the Court of Appeals set forth this case as well. And in the middle of the paragraph, there's a sentence that starts, in other words. In other words, Dr. Newman disputes only to whom section 448.30 applies and does not dispute the scope of information that must be disclosed under that statute. Therefore, our discussion of Dr. Newman's duty under 448.30 addresses only whether Hubbard's alleges sufficient facts to show that Dr. Newman had a duty as a, quote, physician who treats a patient, end of quote, to inform Hubbard about reasonable options for treating Hubbard's pelvic endometriosis, including Dr. Newman's alleged recommendation to Dr. McGauley of doing so by removing Hubbard's ovaries during the February 2018 surgery. You agree with that as well, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, and I'm caught up. I'm up to speed now.
What paragraph was that? 24.
That was, I read 23 first, and I just read 20, half of 24.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, let's go back to the sufficiency of the complaint. Seems to me the circuit court judge and the court of appeals also relied on the Strid decision, which cited to the Just decision, for the premise that a plaintiff, regarding pleadings, a plaintiff is not required to put labels on the allegations and the complaint, I'm reading from Strid now, in order to state a claim. It is the sufficiency of the facts alleged that control the determination of whether a claim for relief is properly pled. Then they cite from the Jost opinion and conclude, thus, if the facts alleged state a claim for abuse of process, alternatively, or in addition to malicious prosecution, the complaint should not be dismissed, even though the theory was not explicitly argued in the trial court. Given that language in Strid, and of course the circuit court made reference to that, as did the Court of Appeals, and the Jost decision, which was one of them, I forget, there was negligence pled and it should have been nuisance, and the court said good enough. So given those two decisions, seems to me that you're hard-pressed to prevail on that the complaint doesn't state a cause of action. So did you distinguish those decisions? Do you say the decisions were wrong? I mean, how do you get around them?
And if I could just answer
you
that.
You may briefly
question.
Answer.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, understanding the law of motions to dismiss and reading the complaints liberally and stating
speaking
a cause of
specifically
action.
Of Strid and Jost, if you're able to respond to those, maybe you're not able to.
I don't know that I have a response to those.
Okay, so that's fine. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. Chief Justice Ziegler and Justices, good morning. I am Guy Fish, representing the plaintiff respondent, Melissa Hubbard. This past weekend, I was reviewing my presentation to give to this court this morning, hoping that I would impress this court with that presentation. I decided to take a break. So I turned on Netflix and watched the movie Erin Brockovich. Actress Julia Roberts plays the lead character, Erin Brockovich, and she becomes, through default, a paralegal. And what Ms. Roberts' character said in that movie, I think is somewhat applicable in this case. I would respectfully submit it was certainly applicable in the last case. Lawyers spin too. Overcomplicate or what is not complicated. And I think sometimes that is true. From our perspective, as far as the issue of this case is concerned, is that Dr. Newman was a treating physician up to and through the surgery where she attended. And she failed to disclose to Melissa Hubbard the recommendation that Dr. McGauley perform ovarian surgery upon her. Simply put, if Melissa had learned of that recommendation before the surgery, she would have declined the surgery. The issue before this court is, does a doctor like Dr. Newman have a duty to disclose that type of recommendation under the informed consent law? It's not about consent. It's about disclosure, which I believe the Court of Appeals rightly separated and identified.
Is it disclosure about the recommendation? The statute says disclosure information about alternative medical modes of treatment. And here, one of those was taking out the ovaries. So isn't it that she didn't, I mean, the allegation, at least in the complaint, is that she didn't tell her patient, Hubbard, that is one mode that could be used, and in fact it was.
Yes, I believe that is the case, Justice Dallet. Clearly, if Dr. Newman was going to perform that type of surgery, she would have disclosed and gotten Melissa's consent. I can't accept the fact that she can shift that duty to disclose by not doing the surgery herself, but recommending it to another surgeon, that she doesn't have to tell the patient as a treating physician of that recommendation. Now, as I understand the briefs by Dr. Newman before this court, there are two rationales that they posit why Dr. Newman does not have such a duty to disclose. They first say that somehow requiring that type of disclosure, it somehow is going to stymie or chill or inhibit or prohibit or discourage or restrict discussions between physicians. I cannot wrap my head around that argument. I believe the more information, the more pertinent information that a treating physician gives to his or her patient is probably a good idea.
I want to just clarify and help me understand what triggers the duty. So in this particular case, what triggered the doctor's duty? Was it the referral, the recommendation, the fact that Dr. Newman was going to participate? Was it any of those or something else?
Well, Justice Brozewicz, I believe it was the duty to disclose that Dr. Newman had recommended that a specific mode of medical procedure, that is ovarian surgery, be performed by another doctor. I think that's what triggered the requirement to disclose to my client.
So if she didn't make that recommendation to the surgeon, instead just made the referral, would she still owe your client a duty?
You know, that's a great argument, and I think it becomes a law of semantics, an argument of semantics. Do I have to have the magic word order or prescribe or designate? We submit. It's not the mode of the communication. It is the subject matter, the content of that communication. And in this case, it was to perform a specific surgery, ovarian surgery, upon my client. That communication needed to be disclosed to my client under the statute, in our opinion.
So would it have mattered whether or not she was in the operating room or whether or not she was planning to participate in surgery?
I don't see any difference, because as a treating physician, she owed that duty, in our opinion.
What happens when physicians consult with each other? I mean, there may be a specialist who's going to conduct a surgery and may want to consult with your GP over, you know, what else you may have going on. Would your GP have to have a separate meeting with the patient to disclose that the GP is going to give their opinion to the other surgeon?
Chief Justice, I believe it's a fact-driven situation. What is the discussion between the physicians? If it's what color of suture can use on the patient, I don't think it's required to be disclosed to the patient. If it's better to do the surgery in the morning in this type of case or in the afternoon, I don't think that has to be disclosed to the patient. But this specific medical mode of a surgical removal of an ovary, I think mandated that that be disclosed to my client.
What if she didn't give a recommendation? What if Dr. Newman didn't tell your client about that being a possibility and just referred her to the other surgeon? Would she have a duty there that she should have still done that? I think we're trying to figure out where the line is.
That is a great question. All I can say to that, Justice Dallet, is a recommendation was made in this case.
All right.
Okay. You argue that things are a matter of semantics. My life depends on semantics here, right? This is what we are about, semantics. So that's what we're trying to figure out, the question of what triggers, you know, what is it here? You've got a statute that says any treating physician, and quite frankly, I take a deep breath, given the hypothetical that was just presented about an ordinary general practitioner, you know, who may, as a treating physician, talk about the timing of the surgery. I mean, that can't be that it is anyone who treats all of a sudden is liable. So what is it here? The statute talks about the risks. The language of the statute, if I can pull it up quickly, and I can't at the moment, but it talks about the risks here. So let me ask, what is the risk that Hubbard was not informed of before the colon surgery happened, or before the surgery happened? What's the risk here?
The surgical removal of her ovaries.
Are you done, Justice Bradley?
Yes.
I want to ask you, and Mr. Planner, I'm going to ask you this as well, just so you know. I just want to talk to you about the last sentence in paragraph 27 of the Court of Appeals decision. And this is where Judge Taylor sort of wraps it all up, where she says, therefore, we conclude that the duty to inform a patient about, quote, the availability of reasonable alternative medical modes of treatment and about the benefits and risks of these treatment, end of quote, applies to any physician who treats a patient, regardless of whether that physician actually performs the disclosed treatment options and the risks and benefits of each. And then she cites the statute 44830, and then she has a footnote. There's footnote 8, which says, as discussed in more detail below, however, the scope of information a treating physician must disclose is subject to statutory limitations, and then she cites all the subsections of 44830. And my question for you is, do you agree with that summation of the Court of Appeals, really the holding of that case, and or do you think that it needs to be limited in any way?
I respectfully agree with that holding, Your Honor. And again, it's a case-by-case factual basis for each situation.
Okay. And I'm going to venture to guess Mr. Planner is going to say that's a little broad. I don't mean to speak for you, and you can come up and correct me if I'm wrong. But if he did come up and say, no, this needs to be limited in some fashion, are there any limitations that you could see that we should or we would need to put on this, if he pushed back on you a little bit?
Your Honor, that type of debate or discussion is akin to what was discussed in the matter before this court earlier. Where do you draw the lines? Sometimes you can't. It's on a case-by-case enforcement basis. I think that's what we have here.
Thank you.
The problem with the Court of Appeals iteration of the law or pronouncement of the law, it is way too broad. Okay, here's the problem with it as I see it. The facts you've alleged for your client are egregious, right? I'm very puzzled about why this case has come to us in the posture in which it has come to us, because as I understand it, your client is complaining that no one told her ovaries were going to be removed, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so whether somebody discussed modes of treatment, it's really here nor there. The bottom line is somebody removed her, Dr. McCauley's alleged to have removed her ovaries and not told her he was going to do that. That's the big problem. So setting aside the facts of your case, we have to be very careful about the pronouncement of law we make. And here the Court of Appeals, in a published opinion, is saying anybody who treats a patient has to disclose reasonable alternative medical modes of treatment. But you have a lot of general practitioners, internal medicine doctors, okay, who are not necessarily specialists, like an OBGYN is a specialist. So is it your argument that a general practitioner must disclose, if we're talking about surgery, all the possible surgeries that could constitute treatment for something? Because specialists are going to have more knowledge than the general practitioner. I think you would agree with me. And a surgeon, especially a general surgeon who handles all manner of types of surgeries, might have encountered a similar case and had a different approach than the general practitioner even knows about. So I read paragraph 27 as imposing a duty on all physicians under all circumstances to impose, inform a patient about all reasonable alternative medical modes of treatment and the benefits and risks of treatment beyond the unique facts of your case. And that's where we have to be very careful as appellate courts to phrase our holdings. So, you know, given my broad scenarios I've posed to you, do you think is that what you're asking this court to rule, that any doctor who treats, even if it's just a general practitioner, hey, I'm coming to you, I've got this problem, that doctor has to know every possible mode of treatment and tell the patient about it?
My response, respectfully, is it's a case-by-case approach. In this case, Dr. Newman was a specialist. OBGYN, she refers to surgery to a general practitioner. It makes no sense. Why did it happen? We don't know. What we do know is none of that was disclosed to my client. Now, I think that it's a unique example of why such a disclosure in these facts would be required. Because it wasn't that it's some mode of operation or procedure. This procedure was discussed between two doctors, a specific mode of surgery, not some general discussion or possibility. It became a fact. It was done. What we're saying is, under those facts, the treating physician, Dr. Newman, should have disclosed to my client of that mode of operation.
Doesn't the statute kind of cabin this a little bit? It says the reasonable physician standard requires disclosure only of information that a reasonable physician in the same or a similar medical specialty would know and disclose. So, like, if she's a OBGYN and he takes out the colon and she didn't know he was going to do that, have anything to do with colons? That maybe that's not, although I don't know, with endometriosis that might be tricky, but, you know, or there's a heart surgeon that winds up doing some kind of heart procedure and she doesn't have a duty under those circumstances to disclose that. That might apply to this GP kind of scenario, right?
I think you're correct. Again, respectfully, it's a fact-by-fact analysis of the relationship of the doctor, the expertise, all of that comes into play.
So, counsel, I think that if you're reading the room, you can probably tell that we're all probably concerned about the broadness of the language in paragraph 27. So while we continue with our questions about this case, if there's anything you wanted to add to that, you know, feel free to. But what I would say to you is, obviously, we've got concerns about paragraph 27 and how broad it is. But I want to ask you this about your briefing. I noted that you emphasized the word prescribe frequently. Can you clarify where that word, where prescribe, should enter into the analysis?
It is in the analysis of the emphasis of the communication between the two doctors. It's a magic language required. It's got to be prescribed. It's got to be ordered. It can't be recommended or designated. And I think that's a misplaced analysis. If the two doctors are discussing and agree upon by a recommendation or an order that a type of surgery is to be performed. Submit respectfully, the patient needs to be informed of that recommendation or prescription or order so they can make the best informed, fullest, and timely decision on the care they're going to receive.
I want to go back to the dialogue that you had or the conversation you had with Justice Dallet, because she says the statute would cabin the circumstances that I presented to you, and indeed it does. But that's the problem with the Court of Appeals opinion as I see it. The Court of Appeals opinion does not invoke that language and creates this very broad holding. And what this court says, I mean, we only need to look to a Martin v. Richards back in 1995, which said informed consent law isn't just about what the statute says. It is, perhaps intuitively or not, also about the patient consenting to the treatment. It's not just about informing the patient. It's about getting the patient's consent, which you're arguing did not happen here, right?
I would also echo the Martin versus Richard case. Would not a reasonable person want to know that the treating physician is recommending to another physician that a surgery to remove organs be performed? Would not a reasonable patient want to know that information in order to make a decision about that surgery? I have to say yes, they should if they want to.
But again, your argument is she didn't even make the decision. It was made for her.
She was not given that opportunity to accept or reject that mode of operation.
That's the bigger problem in your case, isn't it? Not for your case, but the bigger problem is she never got to consent. No one told her.
If it had been disclosed to her pre-surgery, she would have declined.
Of the doctor who performed the surgery is not being sued here.
He was sued in a different lawsuit, Your Honor.
Okay. For informed consent?
For his negligence of informed consent. It was held in Rock County Circuit Court as well.
Counsel, it's my recollection, and it's more than my recollection. It used to be that in Med-Mal cases that the focus was on what would a reasonable patient expect. Then we had the Jandre case, I think it's J-A-N-D-R-E, that entered into the equation of informed consent law, and right after that, the legislature, maybe in 2013, I don't recall exactly, passed this statute that changes what the focus of informed consent is. It's not what would a reasonable patient would expect, but rather the standard now is what would a reasonable physician do under the same or similar circumstances. That's the standard, I believe. Now, having said that with such certainty, let me ask, do you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, if there are other questions from Your Honors, then I would close by saying this. Ms. Hubbard respectfully submits that such a disclosure in her case is encompassed by Section 448.30. In fact, it imposes that duty to disclose that type of surgery that was to be formed upon her. And in fact, it protects her of that right to know in order to make an informed decision of her medical care and treatment. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Planner, before you go too far, I am going to just ask you the same question. If you would, I'm looking at paragraph 27 of the Court of Appeals decision, and the last two phrases, I guess, technically, talk about regardless of whether the physician actually performs the disclosed treatment options and the risks and benefits of each. It does cite the statute, and then the footnote, of course, goes to the exceptions. So my question is, my guess is you think this is too broad, and if you do think that, how could we limit it or cabin it?
I do think it is too broad. That's probably not a surprise.
No, that was a good, it was a wild guess on my part.
I think one way to narrow it, using the alleged facts in this case, is perhaps by looking at the other cases we've cited from other states that have similarly defined to what extent a referring physician has a duty to inform regarding the care that's being provided by the other physician, and that is scenarios where the referring physician actually does more than just talk to the referred physician and make recommendations, actually orders the physician to do a procedure, maybe employs the physician, as I think was the case in one of the cited matters, or where that physician actually performs, at least in part, the procedure. That's a reasonable way, I think, again, at least in the context of the alleged facts here, I believe, to state the duty.
So if our, if we agreed with you in the holding in this case, then we'd have to say that any physician means a physician, we have to say any treating physician means a physician who orders, employs, or actually performs the procedure?
Or has the authority to control the procedure in some fashion, either through an employment relationship with the other physician. But yes, I believe so.
You think that's what the statute is, that limited? The language of the statute is that limited? Because couldn't there be a scenario where the treating physician is one that has the information because that's their specialty, and just because they refer you doesn't mean that they don't then have a duty under the statute?
Well, the language of the statute is very broad, and I think, as with any broadly worded statute, it's subject to interpretation, and we have to look at questions about whether a particular interpretation is reasonable, whether it creates situations that are untenable, and I think that's where the reasoning of some of those other cases comes into play. For example, we raised the concern, particularly under Wisconsin law, about ensuring that physicians freely communicate and offer their ideas and their suggestions and even recommendations without fear of being held responsible for a procedure they don't perform. And I disagree with, I think, the Wisconsin Association for Justice maybe said this in their amicus brief, that that's not a legitimate concern. It is a legitimate concern. We recognize it in other contexts. That's why we have a peer review privilege statute, to encourage physicians, when something goes wrong, there's an adverse result, communications can be had with the peer review committee without fear that those communications will be revealed in discovery or used in court. There's also the concern about, I guess I call it a slippery slope. You know, we have here two physicians. We might have five or six. Patients may have an entire team of physicians treating them, different specialties, but maybe overlapping to some degree. They may be communicating all the time, every day, having conversations about what one or more of them is going to do, how the treatment one of them provides might affect the treatment of the other. They might be making recommendations to each other. Does each one of those people have a duty independently to sit down with a patient every single time they have these discussions and reveal what those discussions were? There are concerns with that, not only just the practical inability of a group of people to do that all the time, but also a concern that if, for example, they're discussing risks of a procedure, if a patient hears the same risk from five different doctors over and over, it may get overblown in their mind. That's a legitimate risk. And finally, we noted, and I think this is a very important point, there is no scenario, I apologize if I can just quickly,
go ahead and finish.
There's no scenario under Wisconsin law given 448.30 where any patient will ever undergo a procedure or a treatment or a test where they are not entitled to be informed by a physician. That's what the statute says. It is not disputed here. I believe, Chief Justice, you asked this question. Dr. McCauley is not in this lawsuit. He was sued. That case was dismissed. And it was after that occurred that this lawsuit was filed. So we're not trying to say, you know, it's too bad for Mrs. Hubbard. Dr. Newman didn't have a duty, so she's just out of luck. The law ensures and guarantees and provides that safety net that there will always be a physician who is required to give consent or to obtain consent and to inform. The question is, how broad of a group do we include in that? And my point is, it can be narrowed from the way the Court of Appeals described it without depriving anybody of any rights.
Thank you. All right. Interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned. We'll reconvene for admissions at 1:30. Please.